KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Sonia Sotomayor is the 111th Supreme Court Justice. She's also the first Hispanic and third female justice. In her memoir, My Beloved World, Sotomayor details her childhood struggle with diabetes, her family life, and her drive to become a lawyer. She spoke at Town Hall on March 10th, 2014. The talk was moderated by Eric Liu.
Every time I hear an introduction of myself and someone says I'm the 111th justice, I think of my abuelita, because she would have had been playing that number for years. And I smiled when Louise said that. So.
Well, Justice Sotomayor, it is such an honor to have you here in Seattle and to get to have this conversation with you. And we're going to, the Justice and I will have a conversation for about 45 minutes or so, and then we're going to open it up to some of the questions that all evening already you've been submitting, and there have been some great ones already. For those of you who have not yet had a chance to read My Beloved World, I urge you to. I know this conversation will be enough to inspire you to, but it is one of the most remarkable testaments, one of the most emotionally candid works from a sitting public figure that you will read. And one of the things that struck me most just about the book are its very opening pages, where you describe, as a young person, one of your early experiences administering insulin to yourself. And kind of having that experience of learning that this chronic disease that had been part of your life and would be part of your life was now calling you at a very young age to take on roles and responsibilities and to steel yourself in ways that young people aren't always asked to do. Why did you open the book with that?
I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what the first chapter would be, essentially. And I actually started it originally with what ended up being the second chapter. And I had done this one separately. And I had a friend who was helping me with the book in terms of reading it along as I wrote. And she came back and she said, "Sonia, read that chapter. All of the elements of your life are in it." And with just those words, I went back and I reread my own writing. You know, when you write with thoughts in your mind about things you want to say, about points that you want to draw upon, and about stories you want to tell. As with all writers, some of my stories ended up on the cutting room floor. But this one, and I went back to reread my own words, and I realized, this feels right. This really is all of the elements, critical elements of my life. First of all, it starts with introducing my immediate family. My father, my mother, my brother. It introduces pretty much out front a central theme of my earlier life when I was young. And then it introduced my relatives and their interactions with my mother and father. And ultimately, it introduced me and who Sonia is, which is pretty much, I haven't really grown up. I know sometimes my colleagues kind of raise an eyebrow at me. I'm about to turn 60 and I still feel like a kid. And the reality is, all of us have a self-image of ourselves. And the self-image is often, I think, really divorced from reality. No, truly, how many, and I'm going to be nasty to some of the men, how many of you ever think of yourself as bald as you age? You have a memory of yourself with a full head of hair, with and I know this for me with 10 pounds less, you know. but for me, that image of that little girl is really the self-image I have. And so picking the chapter ultimately was at a suggestion of a friend. And once I did that, then the organization of the book changed, but I think for the better. And I should say, as you must know, no book is born whole. It is a 9-month labor of love. Except mine was almost 3.5 years. but you know, from the first draft I did to what I was editing till almost a month before the book came out, the audience might be interested in knowing that my preface, I didn't draft till a month before. And it was after I had dinner with some friends, and one of them was a lawyer, and he began asking me questions, and I realized, I think I better explain what I'm doing in my book up front. Because otherwise, he said to me during our conversation, he was a lawyer, oh no, I was looking forward to a book about law. And I said, I better tell them that's not what they're getting.
It's not a book about law, and yet, as we'll return to in a little while, it really describes the way in which you were first caught by the idea of the law and then came to, in a sense, fall in love with the law and appreciate it in all its power. But I want to return even to this opening story. Another of the elements that is inherent in that story is this combination of hearty self-reliance on the one side, but also, as you say, kind of reliance on the web of family that's around you, right? And those two strands are woven throughout the entirety of your book, of your life, of your career. And I want to linger for a moment on the first strand, self-reliance, because throughout your career as a learner, even before you became a lawyer, there was this strong sense of, I've got to figure this out. And how much of that spirit, which you then carried into being a pioneer in a lot of domains, was first formed by this experience and just by the ways in which you had to learn literally to take care of yourself?
There is an awful... We were talking a little bit earlier, and I said to Eric, failure is such a wonderful teacher. And that was one of the lessons I wanted my book to convey. In failure, we can learn so much, not just about ourselves, but about others, and how to manage and deal with disappointment, but also how to pick ourselves up and do something else. Well, I feel the same way about trauma, whether it's dealing with an alcoholic father, and not everybody has alcoholic parents, but most people have lived through some sort of life challenge. If it's not a parent who's affected by alcoholism, it may be a parent who's affected by a different obsession, including work, or a parent who may not be psychologically as strong as you would like them to be. Forget about those kids who are dealing with drug-addicted problems besides alcohol, narcotic addictions, chronic illness. So many of us have some aspect of chronic illness that affects our life. And there is no question that I understood very early on in my life, both through my disease, but through the situation I was living in, that ultimately I had to rely on me to survive, but that I couldn't do it alone. It shocks me when I talk to some people who say to me, I did it alone. And I'm thinking to myself, nobody does it alone. You know, nobody does it alone because if you run a successful business, you have either partners, And if not partners, you have employees who are working with you and giving expression to your idea. That's not you doing it alone. That's you working with others to accomplish something. And I think about that as being a part of everything we do. Now, some people have less of a network of support. I grant you that. But if you forget how much you need others to be successful, then you're going to limit your own success. Mm. Think about most politicians. Most of them draw on the wide network of friends and supporters who believe in them. We think of that as an easy example, but I don't know of anybody in a business setting who succeeds unless some mentor in that business saw their promise and guided them through the system so that they would be noticed.
One of our civic heroes in this region, Bill Gates Sr., the father of Microsoft Bill, has a line he often says, which he can say with some standing, and that is that there is no such thing as a self-made man or woman. And, you know, your path, this recognition that as much as you had to be self-reliant, that you could not be solely self-reliant, leads me to my next set of questions for you. One of the things that's so striking about every chapter, every life chapter in your book, is the way that you are very conscious about seeking out mentors, seeking out guides at different stages. And sometimes, as in grammar school, it's about something very specific where you notice that a classmate is very good at studying or knows how to study, which, of course, we aren't born knowing how to do, but you came to ask her, show me how to do that. Show me what you're doing here, right? And then all along the way, when you made your way to Princeton.
It's interesting because I had not remembered that story, but I had gotten back in touch with Donna through my nomination process as a Supreme Court Justice, and she reminded me of the story. And when she said, I said, yeah, that is right. But that is part of the development of a book or a life story. As you talk to people, they stimulate your memories. And so it was a lot of fun. We did that. My family was shocked at how much I remembered. Mm-hmm. And we argued about details. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, what are the stories, Eric? And I'm just sharing things about the book so people can hopefully go back into it. There's a story in the book about Mike setting up a game that broke my cousin's leg. For years, I thought I was the one who broke it. In writing the book, my cousin Miriam, someone you'll learn about in the book who I adore, said, no, it wasn't you, it was me. As you were going towards him running towards Nelson with Junior on your back, I pulled him back out of your way thinking you were going to hit him, and I made him fall and break his leg. So you'll notice as I told the story that I didn't take blame. But I kept it a little ambiguous. So that's what I did with details that I couldn't get confirmation about. Mm-hmm. But yes, their mentors are terribly, terribly important in life. And I speak to young people about it because often I watch in work settings that people gravitate to individuals who they think are like them. They're looking for sort of someone that you can take comfort from because they either talk or walk or do or approach things the same way you do. And that's very, very comforting. But it doesn't teach you a lot. You know, and what you really need a mentor to be is someone who sets an example of what you want to be. And so if you go into a setting and look at someone who is doing something in a way that you admire, in a way that you think has integrity, or the kind of integrity that you want to emulate, and the kind of caring that you want to be a part of. Watch them. Those will be the mentors that really help you. And I think that that's the message I was trying to develop in my book, was my very conscious choice of mentors based on my deficiencies, on the things that I didn't know, on the things I thought I needed help with. And so you're right, the first one I picked was the good student because I didn't know how to study. Mm-hmm. And that life pattern I kept repeating in every situation, and I still do. I'm a Supreme Court justice, and I watch my colleagues. I watch how they formulate their presentations. I watch how they structure their opinions. And from each and every one of them, I'm taking things that I don't think I do well and trying to integrate more of them.
In the case of your life on the court, in addition to being that kind of perceptive, apt student of the court and of your colleagues, do you explicitly find that you can ask for guidance?
I have spent my life never being ashamed of saying, I don't know. And that may be the hardest thing that most people can do. Admitting that you don't know is difficult. It's difficult for me. There's a certain sense of embarrassment about ignorance that we all feel. But I think very early on in my life, I realized that there is no shame in not knowing. There should be shame in not asking. And, I tell practicing lawyers, they'll always ask me, what's a lawyer's biggest mistake when they get up to argue before a court? And my answer always is answering a question you don't know the answer to. especially if you're in front of the Supreme Court. But how many lawyers do it? And I'm sitting there in a state of shock thinking to myself, why don't you just say, I don't know? Uh-huh. And that, I think, is probably one of the biggest holdbacks on people's ability to grow and develop is that inability to realize that they need help and to ask for it. It took a long time for a friend who once said to me, whenever I got a gift earlier in my life, I would say, you shouldn't have. I really didn't want you to spend that money, you know. I really can't take this. This is too much. And I go on and on like that. And one day a friend said to me, you know, you take away my joy of giving to you by doing that. Why can't you just say thank you? And I learned an incredibly important lesson that day, which is that people do want to help. People do want to give. People want to feel useful. And if you ask, they will happily share with you. And if you take a real interest and not ask just to make talk, but actually take their advice and build on it, it fills them with a sense of pride that they helped. They feel like they're a part of your success. And that is so, so important.
Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor. She spoke at Town Hall on March 10th, 2014. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Sonia Sotomayor in a moment, 925, 94.9 KUOW. President Obama and European leaders concede there's not much that can be done about Russia's annexation of Crimea. A conversation later tonight about the responses the leaders are considering to Putin's possible next moves. That's the Diane Rehm Show tonight at midnight. Forecast for the Seattle area for tonight, lows lower to mid-40s, scattered showers and partial clearing this evening, increasing clouds with a chance of rain after midnight. Friday, highs in the 50s, rain in the morning, showers in the afternoon. Looking ahead to the weekend, Friday night, lows in the 40s and showers. Saturday, highs again in the 50s, showers likely, a chance of afternoon thunderstorms. If you enjoy the programming that KUOW produces locally, like this program, Speakers Forum, why not pledge? The spring pledge drive is going well, and with your help, it'll go even better. Your help is mainly what makes local programming like this possible. Pledge now online at KUOW.org, and thank you. Support for KUOW comes from Taproot Theater, presenting the Seattle premiere of In the Book of through April 26. Lieutenant Naomi Watkins returns stateside with her Afghan translator, and the town goes to war over the stranger's legal rights. Information at taproottheater.org. Support for KUOW comes from Alaska Airlines, supporting Seattle values of ecological sustainability by experimenting with biofuels, fuel-saving wingtip design, and onboard recycling. More at alaskaair.com.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Sonia Sotomayor is the 111th Supreme Court Justice. She's also the first Hispanic and third female justice. In her memoir, My Beloved World, Sotomayor details her childhood struggle with diabetes, her family life, and her drive to become a lawyer. She spoke at Town Hall on March 10th, 2014. The talk was moderated by Eric Liu.
One of the things that is so striking about even your description of that dynamic, whether it's on the court or earlier in your life, when you first went to Princeton, when you went to Yale Law School, when you were in the Manhattan DA's office, at your stint at a corporate law firm, these environments where you weren't afraid to say, I don't know, and afraid to ask questions. The fear that most people have that blocks them there is just an insecurity, right?
Sure.
But for you, one of the things that you write about explicitly in the book is how insecurity was in other ways very useful to you, that there was this recurring pattern that you wrote of self-doubt and furious compensatory effort kind of throughout your life, right?
I'm still doing it.
So how have you learned to kind of optimize? You know, this is the question that's in the air, what we were talking before we came out about, you know, people's focus on tiger parenting or what have you, and just kind of what amount of fear or insecurity is enough? What amount is too much in kind of going after the goals that you set?
I really do think that for me, the line is I'm very, very competitive. But I'm very, very competitive with me. The moment that I start competing with someone else, that's where my self-doubt becomes negative. Because that's when I stop failing. You can always find somebody smarter than you, because the world is filled with people who are smarter than you. There are a world filled of people who are prettier than you. I mean, look at all the actors and actresses on TV. I could diet till I die, and I'll never be that thin, okay? My point is that competition, when it's with others, when you're trying to meet someone else's expectations, someone else's goals, that's when I think it becomes destructive. I talk in my book about setting my limits based on myself, of trying to better myself step by step, goal by goal, and setting those in terms of my needs for what I needed to feel better about what I was doing, whether it was learning how to write properly or just learning small things like at 50 how to dance and swim. I'm the most horrible swimmer you can ever imagine. But I can now float. You don't know what an enormous degree of pride I take in that, from someone who was always afraid of jumping off a boat or jumping into the water. The fact that I can do it now, that's accomplishment. And I think I described in my book that I don't know how to dance anything. I can't hold a beat to save my life. But I found a way of managing because I can follow somebody who has a beat. And so what I do is I go onto a dance floor, I watch the men, and I watch the guy whose beat I can see. I love dancing with Dominicans. They have big, exaggerated steps and beats. I hardly ever dance with Cubans. They do these little tight movements. Can't follow them. That's an exaggeration. You know, there's always an exception to every rule. But my point just being, which is, if you sort of manage satisfaction on your own needs, your own self-set standards, you can take more joy from life. I think it becomes negative when you're doing it for someone else or you're looking at yourself compared to someone else. And there are moments where I struggle with that, like I think everybody does, because we all feel inadequate. It's a natural human course. And when I do that, I have to then backtrack and go back to square one.
You write a lot in the book, both in your educational career and in your early work career, because you entered into places like Princeton or the Manhattan DA office when there weren't a lot of women, let alone a lot of Latinas, in these realms, that you know, as part of that essentially first wave of people who had entered institutions through affirmative action were reckoning all the time with the pressure of other people's expectations, mm-hmm. both those whom, say, in your family, you wanted to inspire and not disappoint, but also the expectations that many people had that, oh, affirmative action baby, I'm going to assume that she's going to fail once she steps into the institution, right? And you write a lot about how you came at different points to confront that and reckon with that. How today do you feel you have learned to reckon with those issues of institutional expectations for what you should be or could be?
At the end of my first or second year on the court, people remain nameless. a person came to me who knows the court well and said, "Sonia, you've really proven yourself. Your colleague told me before you got on the bench that he thought you were going to be an affirmative action baby. Now he says, you're really smart."
Wow.
Now, I can laugh about it now, mm-hmm. but it was tremendously hurtful to me during my nomination process when so many reports were being circulated that I wasn't smart enough. For those who believe that I have any sense of arrogance and wasn't affected by that, I think you misunderstand the challenge that people who have achieved undergo in working to debunk people's stereotypes. But I didn't and haven't been working on the court to prove them wrong. Mm-hmm. I've been working on the court to prove I can do it. Mm-hmm. And that's a very different attitude. I figure if I do my very best, I have to hope that it's enough to satisfy me. And I have pretty high standards. I really don't need anybody else's. No, and I don't mean that arrogantly. I think you have to go back to what I said about setting your own goals. If you set goals that are worth working towards, they're going to be pretty high because most of us really are our harshest critics. I certainly am. And sort of taking it step by step and being grateful for what you do is a way of maintaining that balance.
We were also talking before we came on stage just about the ways in which in so many American conversations, and this played out even during your nomination confirmation process, Americans often speak a language of race when they mean class.
Yes.
So much of your experience got viewed through a lens of race, but it seems to me in reading the book that there's so much that is salient that is just about growing up working class and growing up in a tight-knit neighborhood where that defined your set of your horizons. It defined what you were culturally literate in at the time. It defined so much of your world. And how do you now kind of try to untangle these issues of class and race when you're talking to groups like
you've put a finger on a very important point. My book has appealed not just to Latinos. It's appealed to every single ethnic group in the world. I get letters from people all over the world who have read my book from all over the United States talking to me about how their lives are similar to mine. I went to a law school not so long ago where a young woman from Serbia was telling me of her parents being refugees to the United States, and she began to talk about all of the commonalities of our life. And I don't know that she realized, but I certainly did, that it's not as if poorness has an ethnic identity. In every society that I know of, even in those European countries that have a slightly higher average income, there's a poor class. And that struggle to achieve is the same across the board. So it is not gender, it is not race, it's not ethnicity. It's the human condition of how do you improve yourself when you don't have the game plan in hand. Mm-hmm. You know, I talk about this with affirmative action. Mm-hmm. Affirmative action was a way of getting minority students to understand there was a race they had to run. Because if you didn't even know it existed, how could you compete? Mm-hmm. And so it's the same for most kids who don't have access to information of any kind, you're going to be at a disadvantage. But I think you're absolutely right. I think if we started unpacking that in a better way, we would be having a different conversation, both as a nation and as a community.
One of the things that is so striking about, there's a story in the book when you're at Princeton, I believe, and a sympathetic classmate says to you, gosh, it must, you know, coming from where you've come from, traveling this distance that you've come, you must feel like Alice in Wonderland, to which you said, who?
Yes.
Right? And, again, it's told in a way, you tell the story, and it's told in a way that, you know, I suppose we are meant to be able to chuckle at it, but it is a measure also of not everybody is born knowing who Alice in Wonderland is. Not everybody gets the stock of cultural capital from the way they are raised or the people they are exposed to early on to know these references and the rest, right?
It's interesting because Linda Greenhouse, who's a very well-respected, now retired newspaper woman from the New York Times who used to report on the Supreme Court, she's now teaching at Yale. She's become a very dear friend. But she gave a speech recently at the Phi Beta Kappa celebration, and she was saying that she read my story where I described similarly not knowing what Phi Beta Kappa was when they sent me a letter telling me I qualified and would I pay them.
You threw it away thinking it was a scam, right?
I did. Who tells you they're giving you an honor and asks you to pay money for it? Who in the world does that, okay? That's why I threw the letter away. You want to hear the best story. the weekend before I was nominated for the Supreme Court, the White House had said, we got to talk to your family and see if they're prepared to come down to Washington if the president picks you. So I called my mom. I won't even tell you her story. Suffice it to say that her immediate response was, we can't do that. Omar, my husband's working tomorrow. Serious story. My brother calls me up. Now, mind you, I'm a judge on the Second Circuit. He's a doctor, has a very successful practice in Syracuse. And he says, how are the boys, my nephew, supposed to dress? I said, Junior, in a suit. You'd be going to the White House. This is on the phone. I'm looking at it. And he says, they don't own suits. I said, well, tomorrow is Memorial Day. The stores will open early. Go buy one. Go buy two of them. They're the twins. And he says, yeah, that's okay. I'll make sure I'm ready. And he's about to hang up, and I go, Juan, come back. Juan, that's his name. Junior, come back. Don't take the price tags off until we know you're sure. Until we're sure. And you know what his response was? That's a good idea. How do we escape?
That's what you call street smarts, right?
Yeah. You don't escape your background. You have to embrace it. You have to learn how to laugh with it and enjoy it, because if you don't, it'll torture you, you know? But you really do have to take some measure of pride from it, you know?
Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor. She spoke at Town Hall on March 10th, 2014. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Sonia Sotomayor in a moment, 943, 94.9, KUOW. Tony-nominated actress, vocalist, and songwriter Anne Hampton Calloway talks with Michael Feinstein about her work and performs a set of standards, including Our Love Is Here to Stay, beginning in a few minutes at 10 o'clock on Song Travels. Programming riches mainly made possible by listener contributions. If you haven't taken part in our spring pledge drive, why wait any longer? You can do so right now online at kuow.org. Thank you. Support for KUOW comes from Swedish, announcing the opening of their health insurance information desk for those who have questions about which new health plans in Washington include Swedish in their provider networks. More information at swedish.org. Support for KUOW comes from Best of the Northwest Art and Fine Craft Spring Show at Seattle's Magnuson Park, Hangar 30, March 29th and 30th, featuring more than 100 artists with live music, kids' activities, and on-site parking. Guest speaker Cisco Morris at 1 p.m. Sunday. More at northwestartalliance.com.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Sonia Sotomayor is the 111th Supreme Court Justice. She's also the first Hispanic and third female justice. In her memoir, My Beloved World, Sotomayor details her childhood struggle with diabetes, her family life, and her drive to become a lawyer. She spoke at Town Hall on March 10th, 2014. The talk was moderated by Eric Liu.
I do want to touch on circling back to affirmative action and being part of this pioneering generation in many ways. You also reflect on ways in your life when you've recognized, and at the time, not just in hindsight, that though you've had these opportunities that were made possible, many other people who were beside you, who were right next to you, who were classmates or neighbors, who were cousins, for various reasons, twists of fate, did not have that opportunity. And you describe
one of your books is Accidental Asian.
Right.
Mine is Accidental Success.
Yeah. And with that accidental success, you have what you describe explicitly as survivor's guilt.
Yes.
Say a little bit more about that.
For those of you who haven't read the book, you'll learn that I had a cousin who I considered my soulmate growing up. There literally is not a picture of a family gathering that Nelson and I are not in the same frame. Every single picture of us as children was us together. I ended up going to Princeton and Yale. My cousin ended up dying of AIDS. He took a very different path than I. He was addicted to heroin in high school, and he went to something like, I may be exaggerating, but only slightly. He started at a bunch of different colleges and could never fail. He then did what many people do in similar situations. He went into the military, and he served and was discharged and had actually started to turn his life around when he was diagnosed back then with a very newly recognized disease. And he died. And I talk about the fact that I do have survivor's guilt. He was smarter than me on every single level. And yet, he's the one who pointed out to me what our fundamental difference was. On his deathbed, because we had very long conversations when he was last in the hospital, and one day I told him how much I had envied his brilliance. And he said, Sonia, you're smarter than me because you have determination. I don't. And I realized that that's where the line in my book comes in, where I say a lot of effort will undo the lack of talent. there is 111 justices in the entire history of the United States. There are a bunch of brilliant lawyers out there that should have been justices. They're not. I am. The nine on the court, the other eight on the court are. Those others aren't. It's not just me, Sonia. Mm-hmm. But you need a measure of luck, of that right moment, of having put yourself there, because you can't do it just by lightning striking you. You have to work at getting yourself to the place where you can meet luck. But you have to have a touch of it.
You know, the last question I want to pose to you before we open it up to some of the questions from the audience.
I bet he's only gotten through half his questions.
Hey, we got Dancing with Dominicans. It's all good here tonight. One of the things that I think is, yes, it's determination. It's also initiative. You took initiative at turn after turn in your career, including very consciously once you entered the law. And by the way, that was a vision that you had starting when you were eight or so and saw Perry Mason and kind of began to visualize what it might be to be a lawyer and at the apex of being a lawyer, to be a judge, right? But one of the things you were determined and took initiative to do was to learn how to, quote, think like a lawyer, right? Which, again, you'd think, well, isn't that what law school's for? Isn't that what your leaders of practice are for? And the answer is maybe, maybe not, right?
Yes.
And how did you learn to think like a lawyer?
I learned to think like a lawyer.
And what does that mean?
No. I learned how to think like a lawyer, not in law school, but in the DA's office. Because there, you have a case with witnesses developing facts, testifying to hopefully information that is evidence that can be admitted in a court of law. But when you're arguing that case, both to a jury and then on appeal, what you're doing is building those facts to conform with the requirements of law. It's a way of understanding that facts don't sort of sit in isolation. Thinking like a lawyer is how to take a theory or build a theory around a set of facts. And it is analysis that professors do when they study an issue and then they create a convincing argument. Well, we have the strictures of law that create the framework that we have to fill. And thinking like a lawyer is understanding that logic, how to fill in that framework in a convincing and persuasive way. I know you've read my colleague Steve Breyer's book, The Making of Democracy. And what he says there is, judges have no currency other than the persuasion of their thinking. We can't get you to respect the law as our community unless you can actually read what we say and be convinced by it. And so I think that's what the law is. It's a way of arguing that becomes convincing because it's anchored in a structure that people accept.
You know, it's interesting. One could couple Justice Breyer's comment with one that I think Justice Holmes of long ago said, and I roughly paraphrase, that the law, the experience of the law, or the life of the law is not logic, it is experience.
Exactly.
Right? And if you couple that emphasis that you've just placed on structure and understanding how you put arguments and line them up with that structure with experience and the way in which you bring your own perception, life experience, and the rest to bear in how you understand the world around you, that is the law. And some of these questions now that I'm going to be reading from the audience, I should note there are many, many questions. I'm not sure if it was said before the Justice and I came out here, but one of the strictures we have is we aren't going to pose questions that are about issues that could now or have been before the court, which removes some of these from the stack.
May I invite everyone in this audience who's not a lawyer to actually take the time one day to pick up a Supreme Court case on an issue that you have read about in the newspapers and has upset you. Something's upset you about what the court's done. And read the decision. Don't read the newspaper summary. Don't read the blog summaries. Read actually what's said. I think if you do that, and especially if it's a decision that has split opinions in it, you will actually come to appreciate how difficult our job is. Because for every argument that you can make in favor of the position that you are promoting, there is likely to have been a dissent who's made an equally convincing counter-argument. And I think only if you, as citizens, take the time to do that, you won't appreciate how difficult the judging, that judging can be. Please remember, as citizens, that the Supreme Court rarely takes a case that's easy. No, seriously, the only reason we take a case is because courts below have been disagreeing. And in disagreement, you have to accept as a normal proposition that these are pretty smart people in the courts below who are not coming to the same answer. So there has to be a point at which the law is not clear. Otherwise, it wouldn't be coming to us. And there, if you come to that decision-making with that understanding, you might have a greater appreciation of how difficult some of these questions are and how unclear the law often is. That's why you have judges.
Well, one of the questions, you're emphasizing our role as citizens here, and one of the questions is simply, how do we motivate young people to become more engaged and knowledgeable as citizens? And part of it, I mean, you've just suggested, which is actually to go one level deeper than what comes across your screen if you read an article about a Supreme Court decision. But what else in your encounters with young people have you suggested to get them to be more powerful, active citizens?
To remind them that laws don't spring up made. It's not as if laws get passed sous sponte. You know, this is not an act of a plant just rising from the ground. Somebody planted a seed. Somebody's watered that plant and someone's watched over it. Well, the same thing happens with laws. They've been seeded, nurtured, and fed, not by an invisible force and not a natural force. All of this has been done by people who care about that issue. And to the extent that you don't like the way they care, you have to be the one who rips the weed out. It's not that the laws happen to you. I tell kids all the time, this is not it happening to you. It's your choice of what you're letting happen. If you don't like something, you can't just ignore it and wish it away. You have to make a choice about doing something to make the place you live in better. And that takes self-interest, because who wants to live unhappily? I certainly don't want to. And it takes a measure of idealism, of not being a pessimist, of having hope. And most of us feel more empowered as people when we approach life that way. It's horribly saddening to watch people walk away from problems or to do what lots of people do, which is complain a lot and do nothing. Mm-hmm. It really doesn't help to complain. What helps is to say, what's important to me? And it doesn't have to be the same thing for everybody. Each person should ask themselves, what issue in this society bothers me? And if everybody, we've got how many millions of people? If everybody picked an issue and said, that's the one that interests me, and in that interest did something about it, we would affect a tsunami of change. But we have to sort of light that fire within ourselves. Mm-hmm. You have to ask yourself, what is it that I'm doing to better my world? In whichever way you choose.
Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor. She spoke at Town Hall on March 10th, 2014. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of her talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Kirkland Choral Society, joining with Philharmonia Northwest and Bellevue Chamber Chorus to perform Johannes Brahms' works Tragic Overture, Schicksalslied, and Ein Deutsches Requiem, Saturday, March 29th at 7:30 p.m. at Meany Hall. Tickets at kirklandchoralsociety.org or brown paper tickets. 10 o'clock, KUOW FM 94.9, Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. I'm Bill O'Gray.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.